And a popular Catholic author you might have read some of his books about drinking in Catholicism, or why Catholics eat
drinking with the saints.
To drink with the saints, right?
Very personal.
I think one of my colleagues at the Heights actually contributed an entry to that with the opening. He's a bailer, and he's currently translating Augustine's Cacciacum Dialogues and putting out an edition he's been working on for a few years. He says this about Cicero's relationship to Augustine, or Augustine's to Cicero's. It is astonishing that the subject of Ciceronian influence on Augustine has yet to be adequately explored. The reason for this, in my opinion, springs from a particular assessment of Cicero's intellectual caliber. Cicero did not suffer gladly, quote, puny philosophers, in his words, but ironically, it is precisely into this category which he has been placed. Since the 19th century, Cicero has been dismissed as a second-rate thinker incapable of teaching Augustine anything other than rhetorical flourishes. So the reason for this systemic, culture-wide amnesia, I would argue, has much to do with the bad faith actors of the intellectually aberrant pseudo-traditions of modernity and postmodernity in that world of letters. And it also has more to do, I think, also with Augustine's praise of Roman philosophers in general in the City of God, where he writes, "The Greeks, whose language is preeminent among the nations, have celebrated their writings with great acclaim." Okay, good. Greeks know how to celebrate themselves. "And Latin speakers, moved by their excellence or glory, have been all the more eager to study them, and have made them all the more distinguished," nobilior, "and clearer," clarior. Some translators translate that famous, but it can also mean plain and understandable, like laid out for you to understand. "By transferring them into our eloquence," loquium. Some people translate that into our language. There's a difference, and it's a big one. Now, eloquence is a key concept of Ciceronian wisdom and justice, but that's a much wider topic. One with deep philosophical underpinnings in the City of God. But it's Augustine's clear signal here regarding eloquence that he sees Cicero as the representative of the Romanization of Hellenic thought. That is, Cicero and a number of other Romans make Greek thought clearer, more straightforward, and more intelligible, which makes Hellenic thought stronger in a culture. And that's a strength which many modern and postmodern projects don't want to see. And we still kind of have a dim and high regard for Cicero, standing up for, you know, Republican virtue or rhetoric, some you know, kind of a liberal arts idea of him. And we have a good respect for Roman law, governance, maybe moral philosophy, maybe political philosophy. But those last two are not common knowledge, really. Instead, most people think of Roman wisdom as little more than sort of a succession of aqueducts and administrative violence, you know, sort of bloody, horrible things, and some really long-lasting cement on the app. But in truth, Augustine thinks Cicero is, quote, "a very great and learned man, very fully and wisely instructed in matters pertaining to human life." That is, Augustine gives very high praise to Cicero with respect to his understanding of the active life, moral philosophy, the virtues, and their social application in community. That is, justice. But on matters of religion and metaphysics, he compares Cicero to the fool who says in his heart there is no God, or at least no such God as we commonly mean, one that is omniscient, omnipresent, God, our God, the good guy. Just as in the Confessions, Augustine leaves the epistemology and logic to Aristotle when he talks about his good arts education. The metaphysics to Plato, right, who has, and the City of God has, an enormous amount about the preference for the Platonists with regard to understanding theology or the nature of the divine. But he leaves the moral philosophy to the Hellenized Romans, especially to Cicero and Virgil in a backhanded and weird way, which we talk about in the Q&A, who got Augustine moving. Cicero, he says, got Augustine himself moving in the right direction towards wisdom with his moral exhortation in the Hortensius. In light of this relationship, let me briefly relate a quick set of Ciceronian concepts Augustine silently adopts throughout the City of God that concern Cicero's teachings of justice and how Augustine supersedes them. That is, how Augustine's own grace-filled perspective sits above and, I would say, upon Cicero's naturally good but still flawed conception of justice. Ciceronian justice, or better known as the social virtue, has a number of parts. The first is justice properly, sort of more what we basically consider justice. That justice is properly understood as giving to each his due and doing no harm. It's very much in keeping with Plato's Republic, Book 1, and finding those two things. But Cicero's concept of justice also includes a key second aspect, which is implicit in the Republic, but is teased out more plainly, clarior, in Cicero's On Duties, which is that which is kindness and generosity, or liberality. This sort of understanding, right, that it's not just the negative aspects of justice, making sure no one gets hosed, right, everyone gets what they're due, and making sure that no one's harmed, you don't take something you shouldn't or ruin someone, but that you actually have to be both generous and kind, is why he refuses at times to call it justice proper. Or he'll call it justice, but then he'll say, let's call it a social virtue for a while so you understand. This, by the way, is where you get some of the ideas behind social justice that arose in the late modern period.
From Plato.
Exactly. But that understanding of societas as justice, liberality and beneficence, kindness and generosity, and then doing no harm and giving each their due. Those four combine for true justice. And beneath these, sustaining them all, Cicero says, is something he calls bona fides, good faith. Now, any Christian, worth their salt, should have their eyes light up. Good faith. That seems really important, right? And Augustine's obviously well worth his salt. Augustine relates just these sorts of Ciceronian teachings, but in a magnificently sort of master trolling way. He trolls Cicero so hard, it's unbelievable. When he's talking about the false goddess in Rome, the false goddess of virtue and the false goddess of fides, or faith. In it, he asks this, does not virtue also include faith? Why would you separate the two and make them gods? Like, why are you doing these weird divisions if God is one? Are you sort of mocking their ridiculous multiplicity of gods in Book 4? The Romans saw that virtue is to be divided into four kinds: prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. Since each of these, in turn, has its own divisions, however, faith is among the parts of justice. Indeed, that's fides, is a part of justitia. Indeed, it holds the highest place of all with those of us who know the meaning of the words, the just shall live by faith. He's equivocating nature and supernature there. But he's doing it in such a way that he's also saying, Cicero's got the right idea about justice. He's got the wrong gods, right? The wrong god, right? And he knows it because he knows those gods are ludicrous. And so by having a bad faith, capital F faith, he can't actually keep faith, lowercase f faith, with the people because he has to sort of dance around and we're going to, you know, do the games of Flora, which he knows is garbage, right? But he's stuck with these bad gods. So he can't, even though he knows the virtue, he can't live the human virtue even, because he doesn't have the proper, you know, sort of the contemplative side down. He doesn't have the right faith, capital F. And if you're reading and you know Cicero's teachings on this, Augustine creates this bizarre, nettly briar patch that any, if you were a pagan Roman, you'd be like, I'm trying to, like, ow, like, I can't get in there, but you're using my stuff against me. And he is, but he's paying a high compliment as he does it. Cicero teaches about keeping faith, man with fellow man, charity, and loyalty. Augustine agrees, but points out that Cicero lies when he does not clearly call out the false god of fides as a ridiculous lie. That gets into noble lying and all those problems that Augustine addresses. Augustine's also trolling the Ciceronian or the Roman thinker by hinting in the passage that this is an all too human virtue. Because Rome does not keep faith with the true God, it does not give God what is his due. Therefore, there's injustice in the city on a religious basis. Augustine argues in Book 2 and in Book 19, Rome is, despite such excellent human teachings on justice and good faith and charity, he says it's unjust as a result of having the wrong God. One other part of Ciceronian teaching on justice or the social virtue concerns this addition of kindness and generosity to justice, the social virtue. This loving service to others as part of our nature, and thus the nature of civil society, leads to another key concept, concordia. In essence, hearts together, united in loving the same things. That's all it means, really, concordia, hearts with each other. In fides is the ground of all justice, and concordia is the result, in a certain sense. In Book 2, Augustine takes up Cicero's standard of measure, just this one, to condemn the Roman Republic, first by agreeing with Cicero that vice had corrupted and disunited the Roman people, but then by showing that no such concordia ever truly existed in the Roman Republic by Cicero's own definitions. Because, Augustine argues, some 14 years later in Book 19, after writing a book, memory and dedication to a principle, he argues because Rome's false gods, which are demons really, failed to give both the one true God his due and failed to give the people their due, as they are certainly not due such lies about religion that take them away from, he says, quote, that take them away from the true God and subject them to impure demons. And they can't really unite, this is another one of Cicero's definitions from the De Republica in the mouth of Scipio, they can't really unite in common agreement about what is right, which is required, that's justice, right? And that's concordia. He says, without which you don't have a republic. So if you don't have the right God, you can't order everything properly, and therefore you can't have the right understanding of what's to be valued. Right? That's, you know, you have to have that agreement. You can't have it. So you say, look, Cicero, beautiful idea. Can't have it. Not without Christ. Augustine uses Cicero's beautiful image of a commonwealth, of the justice required for a commonwealth to exist, and of the justice that must reside in the hearts of its citizens, the city soul analogy, right? It's the republic made more clear, more clarion, for the republic to be sustained, right? And he does all this, uses all these things, and celebrates them in order to condemn Rome and all earthly polities as never living up to that standard. Augustine will also adopt this Ciceronian account of justice, kindness, generosity, good faith, and concord as a way of describing the city of God, wherein good faith is first and foremost concerned with keeping faith with God as a real and ruling and utterly transcendent reality in this perfect concordant neutralism. A real God that you can keep faith with as opposed to fake demonic gods that are impossible to keep faith with, or infidelis. And therefore, unjust, the root of justice, good faith. Now, there are hours of things in Cicero's account of justice that Augustine also brings forward that we're not talking about right now, which we could talk about in the Q&A or after drinks, not before drinks. But perhaps I'll just close with one provocative observation. If you do not know Ciceronian thought, you cannot see how quietly complimentary Augustine is being to the things Cicero has taught the Bishop of Hippo. Now, everyone reading the City of God used to know Cicero forwards and backwards, the most translated secular book in the medieval scriptoriums. The thing before it was the Song of Songs and Cicero's On Duties, then the Gospels. That's kind of an indictment of corruption in the Middle Ages, probably, but that was the order. And Cicero's On Duties was the first book off the Gutenberg printing press. This book was absolutely ingrained in society from the time it was written up to mid-19th century. Back then, they knew it front and back. In our own time, Cicero is considered a puny, and not, as Augustine puts it, a very great and learned doctor of man, very fully and wisely instructed in matters pertaining to human life, we may misunderstand the justice of Augustine's teachings because we cannot see him giving Cicero his due.
I think that's an excellent observation that Foley makes, which is that we don't often recognize how indebted Augustine is to Cicero. And in fact, I mean, adopts Cicero's definition of justice as the basis for the basso continuo argument of the whole city of God. So that also, in a sense, shows his dependence on Cicero, his appreciation for Cicero. I want to talk about not his disagreements with Cicero on justice, but his disagreements with Cicero on providence, because I think this actually illumines why he makes the moves that he does with the arguments on justice. Augustine neither seeks to flatter Cicero nor to diminish Cicero. And the same would be true for Rome itself. He neither seeks to flatter Rome nor diminish Rome. But instead, he wants to lead Romans deeper into the cause and purpose and end of Rome. Why Rome? At some points, he asks, why is there no God for the empire, the growth of the empire? What caused this? What's the cause of Rome? Is there any, you've got gods for door hinges. You've got gods for thresholds. You've got gods for door handles. They had a very functionalist religion, right? So anything that had a function in life also had a god corresponding to it. He says, well, you love the glory of Rome, you love the function of Rome. Where's this god of empire? And they can't answer that question. And he also wants them to think about their love of glory and what's the proper terminus for the glory of Rome. Is it reasonable, Augustine asks, is it sensible to boast of the extent and grandeur of empire when you cannot show that men lived in happiness as they passed their lives amid the horrors of war, amid the shedding of men's blood, under the shadow of fear, and amid the terror of ruthless ambition? It's a bit like you want complete justice, but your history shows a lot of injustice, right? With his characteristic insight into the fleeting nature of time and the longing for happiness that can't be lost, Augustine adds, the only joy to be attained had the fragile brilliance of glass, a joy outweighed by the fear that it may be shattered in a moment. This is a really poignant phrase because, of course, the occasion for writing the City of God is the sack of Rome, the sack of eternal Rome that has been shook. Its foundations have been shook like fragile glass. And so this, in a sense, is a poignant entree to the Romans' own sense of foundational vulnerability. What has caused Rome? What is Rome's purpose? What is Rome's end? Is it over? And I think we can relate to questions like this in America, but the question that he finally wants to put to Rome is, why did God permit the growth of the Roman Empire? He's already developed Roman writers who tend toward monotheistic conclusions against polytheism. Cicero is certainly one. Varro is another. These Roman thinkers who are moving in a monotheistic trajectory, and so he can appeal to this sense that if Jupiter is the one god above all the gods, right? Why did Jupiter cause Rome? They can't answer the question. It's an odd question for them, and you wouldn't think so. Why did God permit the growth of the Roman Empire? Roman elites like Varro and Cicero don't have good answers, and he knows it. For his answer, Augustine avers that we will need to have an honest look at Roman history. We'll have to pay attention to the happiness of Rome, or rather the lack of it. We have to pay attention to the contrast between the moderate man
who seeks limits and finds happiness, and the wealthy, decadent man who has no limits but is unhappy and is constantly fearing. And so Rome is the decadent man who has expanded beyond all limits and is unhappy. Why has God permitted that? Why has God permitted the expanse of the Roman Empire? Does God will Rome? And if Rome is eternal, has Rome lived up to the eternal reasons that Rome seeks to embody? It's against this backdrop that Augustine utters one of his famous questions about politics in Book 4. Remove justice, and what are kingdoms but gangs of criminals on a large scale? This, of course, mirrors Cicero's own question in De Republica 3, the words of a pirate to Alexander the Great. Because I rule seas with a tiny craft, I'm called a pirate. Because you have a mighty navy, you're called an emperor. The implied answer is Cicero's negative one, that a true republic requires complete justice, which is to say it requires conformity with the transcendent end of justice and what is owed to the supreme good, which our intellect longs to know. It's in this sense that a republic can be under an aspect thought of as eternal, insofar as it is ordered to eternal truths. Now, an honest look at Roman history, Augustine says, yields shadowy resemblances of two cities. We can see the wicked and we can see the good. We can see the way in which Rome's vices have been the very cause of her decline, and the way in which Rome's own virtues have been the very source of her growth and good. Augustine begins his assessment by comparing Roman growth to Greek and Assyrian growth, to humble Rome. The Greeks protected and did not extend the frontiers of their dominion. They're like the moderate man who knows their limits, right? But Rome thinks they're great, right? They didn't become great through scaling up, through luxury and decadence. And then, whereas Rome rose through imperial expansion, the Assyrians provide a different contrast. The Assyrians pursued the path of expanding their empire by making war on their neighbors. There's a general agreement among historians, Augustine writes, that their kingdom lasted so long that the Roman Empire has not equaled its duration. Indeed, 1,200 years of imperial expansion through war. And Augustine says, and if this was during the time of Christian religion, would you expect the Assyrians to blame Christianity for their downfall? No. They were better men. They took responsibility for their own empire. And it's a pointed way in which he wants to show his elite Roman readers that they have a relatively young republic, which is strong as well as weak, and it has no right to blame its own failures on Christianity. Augustine turns pastoral as well as providential with respect to Rome. There is no need to despair of Rome's recovery at this present time. Who knows what is God's will in this matter? Augustine is no determinist, but he's concerned about Ciceronian determinism. That actually Ciceronian accounts of God are so deterministic that he has to do away with God, or do away with the true God. In truth, the expanse of Rome coincided with the expanse of her false gods, who brought the people towards a false gaze. He noted in his previous book that Rome's unhappiness was in direct proportion to the number of false gods she accumulated. Gods for everything, as I said. Each man appoints one doorkeeper for his house. But the Romans appointed three gods for the doors, the hinges, the threshold. He's got other jokes about gods. Some naughty jokes. No, I won't.
The mysteries.
The mysteries, yes. As I say, there's God's for every function, including the marital functions. His attempt here is to move his Roman reader to the notion that if there is a God above the gods, that this God has to be, in a sense, thought of causally. The God who has moved Rome is worthy of our reflection. But Cicero and Varro don't have a God which can be seen to be the cause of the goodness of Rome. Right? They can have an account of how the lower gods that they believe are lies, deceivers, those can cause the vices, they can admit that. But they don't actually have a God who can properly cause anything good in Rome. For both Varro and Cicero, a kind of Stoic pantheism reigns in which God is understood as the soul of the world. Well, if God is understood as the soul of the world, God's really a part of the world, right? Or God is constituting the life of the world. Varronian and Ciceronian monotheism collapse the infinite distance between the creator and creation. If God is the soul of the world, then it seems that Varro and Cicero aren't really directing their gaze at a truly transcendent God who can truly cause from as an uncaused cause. Then we're a bit like in the world of St. Paul saying that these men worship not the creator, but creation, a deified creation, a world soul God. Are actually is an idol of human invention. And so even Varro and Cicero come up for the critique of idolatry that the civil theologies and the fabulous theologies that he's already critiqued. So Augustine pushes against the idea that God can be part of the world and wants to make it clear that Cicero's God is not sufficiently transcendent. He wants to make this clear partly so that they can understand precisely how Rome can be willed by God. How Rome can be willed by God in such a way that Rome doesn't lose her freedom and her love of glory even. He certainly believes that Rome has virtues, that Rome has the good sense to extol right living and meritorious action. He certainly is in praise of all the natural virtues that Cicero loves. But if we think about the gods, or even the god above the gods, how can they be agents of provision? Do the gods have any good role or only vicious roles? And does the god above them have any good role or only vicious role? How can Rome be said to be eternally ordained for glory if her God is detached from her citizens' freedom and formation? This is statecraft, is soulcraft stuff. Rome is unhappy. And this brings Augustine to the point why they're unhappy. Rome is unhappy because they believe in false gods. They believe in fate. They believe in astrology. They believe in a God, even their monotheists believe in a God who's incoherently determinist, who hasn't really provided a way for Rome to attach herself to true glory, to freedom, or to justice, because it hasn't had a truly transcendent and eternal standard. Augustine tells us that Cicero's problem is not that he holds Rome to the standard of complete justice. This is where he agrees. But that his theological or religious vision has turned destiny into fate. And it's at this point that Augustine tries to break open the closed frame which entraps God into a Stoic determinism. Augustine tells us, contra Cicero in Book 5, that we shouldn't think divine foreknowledge and human freedom mutually exclusive. Cicero wants to preserve human freedom. But because he understands God as the highest cause within an order of causes, a closed order of causes, Cicero can only imagine a conflict between divine foreknowledge and human free will. It is, for Cicero, a zero-sum game. If the causal order is fixed, we are ordered by fate, and there's no freedom, in Cicero's view. And once there's no freedom, all human life is overthrown. Law and justice, as well, become meaningless if God has perfect foreknowledge, Cicero thinks. That perfect foreknowledge for God is in competition with human freedom. It's an either-or. God is providentially ordering the world, including Rome, or we've got human free will. If you choose providence, you lose free will. If you deny providence, you become irreverent. This is the trap that Cicero, that he finds Cicero to be in. It's a zero-sum account of divine and human competition on a single cosmic plane, where Augustine will fundamentally dissent. The religious mind chooses both, foreknowledge as well as liberty. How? How, Cicero will ask. How do you choose that? How can you choose both? He does not think you can choose both. Against such profane and irreverent impudence, Augustine writes, we assert both that God knows all things before they happen, and that we do by our own free will everything that we feel and know would not happen without us. We do not say that everything is fated. In fact, we didn't know that anything happened. In fact, we don't think that anything happens by destiny, that is, by astrology, by the stars. Now, if there is for God a fixed order of what causes the world, it doesn't follow that nothing depends on our free choice. Our wills, Augustine writes, are themselves in the order of causes, which is to God fixed and to us relative. That is, to Augustine, we are all efficient causes because we proceed from the uncaused cause who has made an order of causes. Cicero thinks that God is at the top of the chain of causes. Augustine thinks that God is, in a sense, outside that chain, causing the order of causes. This is now approaching philosophically a truly transcendent account of God, one that he likens more to Plato. A truly transcendent account of God that we have not made for ourselves and whose agency does not compete with ours within a single closed order. Indeed, everything in the world is an effect as well as a cause, Augustine writes. But God is not an effect. God is only a cause. And he can only be a cause without a cause. One who creates the order of causes and knows it from the outside, as it were. It's a bit like C.S. Lewis's example of being so high up that you can see the beginning and the middle and the end of a parade. But this knowledge does not limit the freedom of anyone in the parade below. As Augustine says, the religious mind chooses both foreknowledge as well as liberty. The fact that God foreknows that a man would sin does not make a man sin. If you were not willing to sin, then God would not have foreseen that refusal, in the sense that there is, if you will, a non-compete clause. You may be wondering what this has to do with Rome and the politics of providence. Here's the upshot. To break the zero-sum logic of Cicero, Augustine uses something like a formal, efficient distinction between divine and human causality. Once he distinguishes between the uncaused cause and the order of causes, once he distinguishes between God as cause alone and an order which has cause and effect, he's beaten Cicero. The larger point is, in his providence, God wills the birth and growth of Rome on a formal level, without ever willing everything that Rome has done, which has been unjust. Right? That God is the cause of all the blessings that come from Rome, but none of the sins which are that Rome is culpable for. And this is, in a sense, to show that God made Rome, and God is the cause of everything that is good in Rome. but God, as he says about the devil, God made the devil, but he didn't make him wicked. You could say this about Rome. God made Rome, but didn't make Rome unjust. But God can indeed bring Rome to her highest end. And this is where we loop back into the argument about justice, is that it's actually proposing a truly transcendent God, who's an uncaused cause outside of the order of causes, that you need to you need a means for attaching Rome's love of justice to a transcendent standard, and you need an account of common good, which is related to the highest good. And if you lack that, you're not only going to collapse God and creation, but you're going to collapse a republic. You're going to collapse a republic because it's all going to turn in on itself, a bit like the heart turned in on itself in the confessions. You have the city turn in on itself because it lacks the transcendent standard, a truly transcendent standard. And so Cicero's problem is not that he's moving towards one God, but that the one God towards whom he's moving is impotent and is actually not an uncaused cause outside the order. It's just a part that must be weak in order for us to be strong. And so it's a very cunning argument because it's pushing on Rome's own love of strength, its own love of its own characteristics, its good characteristics, and saying, what causes those? You don't have a good answer for that. God is the cause of the good things. You're the cause, or sometimes the demons are the cause of the bad things. The false gods are the cause. So to bring Rome to a proper understanding of a providential, transcendent God who causes things and can, in a sense, be the very transcendent standard which Rome lacks and Rome needs in order to survive. And this is why it holds out hope for Rome. Thank you.
Jim, let me play the role of Cicero for
sure.
and sort of bring in the other problem, which is superbia, pride.
Yeah.
Okay, we're in charge of all the bad things that Rome did.
Right.
We take credit for those. That's us, our free will, doing something bad.
Mm-hmm.
What about our free will
which
doing something?
Admit, right,
yeah,
right. Absolutely.
What about our free will doing something good? Don't we still get stuck in the loss of the free will to do good under if God is the cause of all the good things that happen in Rome? That's the worry that the Ciceronian free will argument would want to take up next, right? Wait a minute. God is the cause of all the good things.
Mm-hmm.
Then what about my good choices?
And that's precisely where Augustine wants to force him to say that he's got a zero-sum game lined up where I should say, Augustine's in the anti-Pelagian controversies as he's writing this, so this is not too far apart from his debate with the Pelagians and about what we can merit. And of course, Augustine thinks that we can merit certain things in the natural order, our poor little virtue, he calls it. And then, of course, in the supernatural order, we merit by grace. I think he wants to say to Cicero that God is the power of all the good in you. Right? All the good in you is caused by God. Your recognition of that is not a denial of your power. Right? But for Cicero, it is a denial of his power because there's a direct competition between God's causation at the top of a closed kind of imminent frame. I mean, Cicero has an imminent frame like Kant has an imminent frame, in a sense, in which you can't really break out of that frame. You can only put God at the top. And this makes it almost impossible for Cicero to be able to recognize that God can be the power which is causing, and I can have agency too. And I ask you a question.
You can.
I ask you a question. My question for you is, do you think the way in which Augustine treats Cicero's account of God is correct?
The way that Augustine treats Cicero's account of God?
Yeah, because Cicero kind of is tricky here. He sometimes, sometimes seems like an atheist, and sometimes he seems like a monotheist.
And
it's a rhetorical kind of sophistication, but there's metaphysical meat there, too.
This is where, a lot of people think Cicero is a Stoic, and he's not. He's an academic, and that means that he has a certain skepticism where he's offering a probability argument, which is a kind of, it looks like, it's not quite the same thing, but it's a pseudo-humility, which says, I don't have this 100% worked out, so I'm going to pose dialogic questions on these very high-end. So like when he gets to the you were saying, the frame, when he gets to the edge of the Truman Show, that sort of says, like, is that a light or a cloud? Like, it might be one or the other. Well, okay, let's not go there. That's too high for me. So one of the things Cicero loves to do is collapse fractious Greek philosophers.
That's right.
Dialogic voices in Plato. Like, well, actually, and that's actually one of the why rhetoric is part of philosophy, is because it actually sees things as a unity and not as discrete things. Right? It looks for wholes.
Right.
And the beautiful. And that's one of Cicero's great gifts, is he can collapse it. Augustine, the trained Ciceronian, knows how to do that, and that's the glorious part of the City of God, where he crushes all of philosophical pagan thought into, like, well, really, it's just saying this, right? The city of man, right? We want self-sufficiency. You know, he does this over and over again. He does that to Cicero, constantly.
Yeah.
And in one sense, you say, it's unfair, because Cicero didn't come out and say it, because he wasn't 100% sure. Mm-hmm. But in another sense, it's totally fair, because you are holding yourself up as the orator, Mr. Eloquence, and by eloquence it literally means the guy who is wise enough to see the whole cosmos and give it as a gift to other people. The philosopher has been replaced in Roman thought by the orator.
Yeah.
Right? So he has to take him to the woodshed for his own claims. Mm-hmm. So it's precisely Cicero's superbia why he hangs him on the hook of his dialogics.
Yeah.
Because it's fair. Even though it's not fair in one sense, right? But if you're aware of Cicero's claims for himself, right, the big claims for himself, and then you're aware of his own use of collapsing dialogues, right, that's good, fair treatment, even though it's sad for poor Cicero.
And it's worth remembering that Augustine was one of Rome's greatest rhetoricians. He was a master of rhetoric at Milan. He could have had an immense career in the empire if he hadn't met Ambrose.
You read the confessions and he talked to the senator and
that converted consul.
And
that's right.
This bishop came to see me and he was like a catechumen at the time with Ambrose.
And Augustine's great expertise was his knowledge of Cicero. I mean, his fluency with Ciceronian thought is just so great, as you say, he's able to exploit it.
Now we have some time for questions.
Thank you both. This has been incredibly, incredibly helpful. So one question I had, you were talking about the similarity between Cicero and Augustine, sort of out of the gate, right? They're both orators. But there's one similarity but one in particular that I'm thinking of, which is once Augustine converts, he's not involved in statecraft, at least so it seems to me. Maybe the reason for that is just that he can't be not consistent with his particular spiritual calling, but it's interesting that in De Officiis, right, Cicero is making the claim that there have been a lot of really good philosophers out there and a lot of really good statesmen, but they haven't really combined the two functions into one. And that's what I'm going to try to do in this book, basically. And so I'm interested
all the two functions of what?
The two functions of the philosopher and the statesman, the orator.
Okay.
Right. And so I'm interested to hear your thoughts as to why Augustine seems to take a different path there.
Why he takes a different path from Cicero? Mm-hmm. Because he becomes a Christian and believes and becomes a priest by acclamation and becomes raised to the episcopate. And in a sense, you could say he sees himself as taking up that role as a bishop. It's a different societas. It's a societas perfectus that will later be called, in which he is taking up the role of ruling and operating on the gift of ruling. And so I would say one level, he's very involved with combining the two. And you read Augustine's letters, I mean, half of them are letters to judges appealing for mercy in capital punishment cases.
Using Seneca's De Clementia.
Yeah, so, you know, it's there is, in a sense, I would push back and say, actually, I think you could even argue here that he's found the fulfillment of the Ciceronian ideal in the church. And I think that's a typical move for Augustine, is to make a fulfillment argument, not a denial argument. That there's something true in Cicero, here's where its fulfillment is. And I think he is the perfect philosopher king in that regard, as a bishop who we still read today. He single-handedly beats the Pelagian controversy. He's crucial in the relationship between church and ecclesial negotiations around the Donatus controversy, which is about social peace. And so I would say he fulfills Cicero's aims better than even Cicero.
Just to more or less build on that, the first part I mentioned, he's called to the priesthood. That's one of the great gifts of the city of God, is an understanding of vocation. Right? Sort of love and do what you will. And okay, that's not exactly, I mean, that's, you gotta take that, okay, what does that mean? Unpack that, but it means look, love, and then listen to what God's calling you to do. If you're called to be a bishop, right, then you're going to fulfill all of the duties, right, that God puts you under. Some of those are civic duties, right, like we mentioned, but then other people will be called to the secular state. Get married, go have family, go be in your city and be a citizen. And those people have to go do that kind of thing. In which case he sort of, you know, there's this new framework of freedom that grace provides, that different people are called to different things, right? But that's one aspect, is the freedom which it provides, quite frankly, for a hierarchy, right, of states. But then there's also the equality of states in the fulfillment argument, that as a priest and a bishop, I'm still going to be doing civic things through clarifying all of the contemplatio issues, which we know from what we've just said here today and from Cicero and from the church, has direct relations down to all these practical matters.
Well, one, just to piggyback on that, and I'm sure there's another question, is he ends book five with Theodosius. Theodosius, of course, is Constantine is more famous to us, I think, because he makes Christianity illicit religio. But Theodosius is the really important emperor because he makes Christianity the official religion of empire. And in 381, he's bashing pagan statues, you know. He's burning Apuleius's books, this pagan. He's pagan who wrote about Christianity, against Christianity. So Theodosius is the kind of ideal emperor, the emperor who is actually promoting a commonwealth which is rightly ordered to the proper transcendent standard, which has the right kind of civil religion, the kind of order which is one in which the soul can be properly formed. So I think his view of Theodosius or of any Christian emperor is not that a Christian emperor is going to automatically make for a happy republic, but that they are the kind of emperors who order things properly for the soul. They relate the soul to their proper end.
And in particular, through negation of the pagan rites, right? These are demons that are leading to vice. And this is, it's the state's it's the state's job to be concerned with the morals of the people.
To not be indifferent to gods that can lead people astray.
Because you can't sever the divine understanding from public morals.
That's right.
Which is the whole argument we discussed.
There's something I'm working on in my book on this, between the gaze and the good. Augustine's interested in how we direct our gaze and what we direct our gaze to, and the intellect needs to be able to see the highest good, and the gods are these. When we gaze at the gods, the Roman gods, Augustine thinks it's pulling us down rather than raising us up, and it's deforming us as citizens. And so, really, the question of having the proper terminus, the proper transcendent standard, is essential for citizenship.
One other tiny note, near and dear to my heart. Thomas More made one of his first public lecture in London was on the political teachings of Augustine's City of God. So I'm just gonna give a series of public lectures at St. Lawrence Jewelry, right near Tower Hill, ironically, on just the political teachings. So I do think the fulfillment argument is, we didn't even get into how many political ramifications flow out of the things we were just saying. The rights of peace, the kinds of institutions, what law has to deal with if you understand superbia, how you handle power if you understand the libido dominandi, how to divide it. Lots of things to do with what some people think is simply and exclusively a new science of res publica. A lot of that is very much there, but it's reflective, you know, through a prism of a much more theological argument. But it's, you can pick up those crumbs if you're careful, and guys like Moore did. He spent a lot of time there.
This will be the last question.
Hi, so this is a somewhat speculative question. Given what Augustine says about faith and justice and the true God, what do you think Augustine would make of modern religious pluralism?
Good.
Yeah, so we didn't get into Book 19. 19 deals with, in a sense, the societas perfecta of the church is his view of how a polity would be perfectly ordered if it recognized the true one true faith. But he also provides a different definition of a republic, in which you could have a scalar account of republics, which were better or worse according to their loves. Right? I would think that if you had a polity which was indifferent to the truth, it would be pretty low down the scale. And I think that there are certain accounts of religious pluralism that really manifest as indifferentism to the truth. And so for him, that would be very low down the scale. And importantly, moving down the scale towards greater and greater injustice. The fascinating thing to me about Augustine's argument here is that, in a sense, he can imagine a top scale in which, you know, for example, I sometimes think of a 19th century America that can recognize God but doesn't give any definition to civil religion or a national church or something. I think Augustine would have seen that as really much closer to the top of the scale, even if it wasn't his ideal. But as you move away from indifference to truth, indifference to one God, you move down the scale towards injustice, and at the bottom of the scale, you start seeing martyrs. And this is the really fascinating thing about Augustine, is he says, this is good news when you see the martyr. Because the martyr is, in a sense, this metaphysical thorn in the flesh of a polity, which reveals to the polity its own metaphysical disorder. And reveals to the polity also hope that it can turn, that it can repent, and go back up the scale. And so the martyr is this
not only the seed of the church, but also the seed of civic renewal, if I can put it that way, which I find really attractive, because it breaks you out of the mold of thinking that you're either on a total declension narrative or you're on some Whiggish history in which we're always getting better. And Augustine just doesn't think it works that way.
He rips the cycle and it's apart.
That's right.
He says, yeah, okay, there are natural cycles that are like these lower order carousels of cycles, but there's also just divine agency. I can do something new here.
That's right, miracles.
And he can, and even the
martyrs, miracles, and you, saints, the witness of ordinary Christians, all of this is our nodes in which you can turn the order around.
And even when you get into his anthropology, finally in books 11 through 15, he starts to explain how souls can create, like, I mean, God blows a certain soul with his talents and charisms into the universe.
Yeah.
Right?
Human person is one of the
miracles. I'm going to make an Augustine because I want to save Roman civilization, right? You know, all of those sort of things.
Which is where you really ramp up the providence argument, right? Here's the big takeaway, is that Cicero's God is not active in history. Augustine's is. Augustine's God is active in history, moving in history. There's no deterministic line which God cannot break and turn and move in new directions through miraculous black swans or what have you. But I think people think of Augustine as a pessimist, and I think that's just a grave injustice. Augustine is the most profound theologian of grace and hope in the world.
We have the theologian and then the poet guy. So the lower order version of that, essentially, that I think doesn't disagree with any of that, is what Augustine says about that scalar. We spent a lot of time talking about how he destroys republicanism, like as impossible. Mm-hmm. But then he says there's a practicable definition of republicanism,
right,
too. Right? I mean, we have another one that we talk about, like the American Republic or the mm-hmm. Republic of the Swiss Cantons, Republic of Venice, or there's republics out there, or the British monarchical republic. And in that sense, there is, I think, in the theological teaching about the providential framework that outside the causes, there's God's up above the box, and there's all these things happening, some of which he doesn't will because there's free will to do the wrong, then you have a certain tolerance for error. No error, no rights to error, but there is a godly reflection, and we're always imitating God in the way we set up our polities. There is a kind of tolerance for error that can be dealt with depending on how erroneous and vicious the people are, right? Because people need to be moved in stages towards virtue, and you have to deal with things in, you know, on that scalar, right? And so there is room for pluralism because of the order of peace if the situation demands it, right? To an extreme, provided it's not the downward attitude of pessimism, that I'm accepting this because this is the way everyone's always going to be erroneous, discordant, not understanding one another, not having that real justitia, real good faith, real concordia, right? Or you say, I'm going to tolerate this order of peace now while I am doing everything in my power to get real good faith, capital F faith, real concordia, right? So there's pluralism headed up and there's pluralism headed down, right? And that's more, I'm just developing what Chen's saying, but so I think in that order of peace, the rights of peace that he talks about a lot, there's an acceptance and a willingness to deal with pluralism if you have to, but never accept it.
Revealed truth for Augustine, supernaturally revealed truth for Augustine is always something which crushes error, but never crushes people. If I can put it that way, right? that whatever you want to say, Eric has no rights, Augustine would say, okay, does he use the rights of language himself? But he'd say, yeah, of course, Eric has no rights. Correct, crush errors, but never crush the person. At some point, I can't remember where, but he talks about the human person as the jewel at the heart of the commonwealth. And that's absolutely right. And so whatever kind of polity, this is a way to judge polities, is how does the polity treat the human person as a jewel at the heart of the commonwealth, and how does it treat the creator of that jewel, right? God. And that's how you judge a polity, as a true human person, as a true God.
And that's very Ciceronian in regard to the individual conscience that has to be respected, that you have to deal with this person who has a soul and a conscience, and it has to be brought along.
Well, thanks for joining me.